Today is Monday, June 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. How are nationwide U.S. protests affecting calls for police reform?
On the police side, like, too bad. And within a day, their mugshots are floating around social media.
Plus, we take a look at the history of the intersection of African-American history and police brutality.
Many people have known around in the U.S. and around the world for centuries that there's a problem with race-based police brutality.
And the latest updates on the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll have those stories and more next. Police use flashbangs and pepper spray in an attempt to move protesters down the street in Seattle early Monday after the death of a black man in custody last month led to some of the biggest protests seen in the United States. In Washington, Senator Mitt Romney, a member of U.S. President Donald Trump's Republican Party, joined protesters during a march Sunday, the first known instance of a Republican lawmaker taking part in the demonstrations during the past 2 weeks. The protests followed the May 25th killing of George Floyd, who died after a white police officer pressed his knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes. That officer has been charged with murder, and the three other officers who stood there also faced charges. A bystander cell phone video captured the scene as Floyd pleaded with the officer, choking out the words, "I can't breathe." In Los Angeles, California, former police officer Casey Coleman joined protesters there because of the racism she faced and told Reuters News it was time things changed.
Every day when you wake up, you are in fear of your life as far as driving, being pulled over by the police, shopping, everyday interaction. It's not just once in a while. It's an everyday. It's a way of life for most African-American people in this world.
Protesters also assembled Sunday in major cities such as New York, Chicago, and Atlanta, where leaders lifted nighttime curfews put in place after earlier demonstrations were marred by vandalism and looting. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio said on Sunday his administration plans to move an unspecified amount of funding from the police department to youth initiatives and social services. In the southern state of Texas, mourners are gathering on Monday in Houston to view George Floyd's casket before his funeral and burial tomorrow. An aide to former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden said the Democratic presidential candidate planned to travel to Houston, Texas, to meet with Floyd's family and to give a video message at the funeral. Across the Atlantic Ocean in Britain, tens of thousands of people took part in a protest on Sunday, some of which ended in a police standoff. More than 40 people were arrested and 27 officers were injured over the weekend. Reuters' Carolyn Malone has that story.
Mass peaceful protests in London to condemn police violence Sunday later gave way to violence. The crowd of tens of thousands dwindled into a small group of people who faced off with police. Crowds shouted chants in support of the Black Lives Matter movement in the US and for better treatment in the UK.
We want to be treated the same way that you lot are treated. We want to be treated with the same respect.
Police arrested more than 40 people over the weekend for offences including violent disorder and assault on emergency service workers. At least 27 officers were injured, including two seriously. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson said on Twitter, "People have a right to protest peacefully while observing social distancing, but they have no right to attack the police and that the demonstrations have been subverted by thuggery." Earlier in the day, protesters vandalized a memorial to former British leader Winston Churchill, calling him racist. And in Bristol, the statue of slave trader Edward Colson was pulled down and thrown into a river. There were similar scenes in Belgium, where police used tear gas and water cannon to disperse protesters who'd gathered near a colonial statue. It marked a second weekend of demonstrations in Europe, mirroring protests in the U.S. sparked by the death of George Floyd in police custody.
Carolyn Malone reports for Reuters News. Some Trump administration officials are contesting one of the core tenets of the protests, that police brutality is a result of systemic racism. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has more.
No racist police was one of the chants of protesters this weekend.
The outrage that Americans are feeling today about the death of George Floyd is very real. It's very legitimate.
But appearing on ABC's This Week, acting Homeland Security Secretary Chad Wolf challenged the refrain.
I do not think that we have a systemic racism problem with law enforcement officers across this country.
There's always the ghost in the room.
Also on ABC's This Week, Congresswoman Val Demings.
We have been fighting systemic racism in this country for 400 years.
A former police chief, Demings says the nation needs to
hold police accountable,
examine training standards and use of force policies, and who exactly is being hired in law enforcement. Ben Thomas, Washington.
In Minneapolis, the Midwestern city where George Floyd died, the city council has passed a veto-proof resolution to disband its police force in favor of a community-led safety model. Earlier today, I spoke with Simone Weichselbaum, national law enforcement reporter for the Marshall Project, a nonpartisan, nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. And I asked her what this means for police reform in the United States.
Everything's moving very quickly. When I was on your show last week, I had mentioned that cries to defund police are more of cries from the activists, and let's see what cities are going to do. So on one side, you have Minneapolis, who... yes, that defund, but it's really reimagining public safety. But you do have political pressure mounting. So to have police departments now arresting not an officer who obviously, you know, basically killed someone, but those watching as the incident occurred. And I find Buffalo actually more interesting.
That's a fairly interesting thing. So for our listeners who aren't familiar with that, what was caught on film is an elderly gentleman approaching officers. He was pushed down to the ground. He received some injuries. And the police force suspended two police officers in Buffalo, New York. And after that suspension, 57 other members of that same unit resigned from participating in that unit, but not from the police force. And then authorities decided to charge those two officers with felony assault.
Right. And it was definitely a 180. Like Minneapolis, it's a video scene around the world. Also, we've written about their policy, and officers are not allowed or not supposed to allow an officer to commit abuse. You're supposed to intervene by department policy. So that's not as surprising. What to me, Buffalo, where you have it's, I would say, a red pocket. It's not a liberal city like New York City. It's near the Canadian border. And initially, when that video came out, officials there seemed on the police side, like, too bad. And within a day, their mugshots are floating around social media. So I do think there is change happening. I liken this to what happened in the mid-90s after Rodney King, after the riots, when those cops were acquitted. And that's when Congress actually released and approved a bill that allows DOJ to come in and sue police departments to reform. And that was also a political moment in police reform. So now here we are again, not only are activists calling for it, not only are there viral videos, but now you have policymakers actually doing something.
So what kind of challenges lie ahead? Because last time you were here, you also mentioned there were 18,000 different police departments all managed independently.
Well, I think this is how what we're actually seeing right now. So you have Minneapolis, who's like, we are the city council voted to the point where the mayor can't even veto it. We are going to reimagine the police department. That's a city under siege. New York City, where I live, the mayor is now proposing cutting about 5% a year from the police budget, and really cutting from this intersection, which is something else we're going to work on, intersection between social services and policing. The thing to watch, too, is we have Congress today, House and Senate congressional members who are Democrats are going to propose a bill calling for a lot of things. So it'll be very interesting to see what the Republicans are going to do.
Simone Weichselbaum is the national law enforcement reporter for the Marshall Project. Now, to dive deeper into why the protests in 2020 seemingly have more momentum than in years past, I reached out and spoke with Dana Weiner, associate professor of American history at Wilfrid Laurier University in Waterloo, Canada, via Skype. We discussed the intersection and trajectory of issues affecting African Americans and police brutality.
It's important to recognize that these protests are not only about Mr. Floyd himself and people's sadness about what happened to him, but many people have known around in the U.S. and around the world for centuries, that there's a problem with race-based police brutality and widespread anti-Black violence more generally. Many scholars and activists trace the origins of U.S. policing back to slave patrols during the time of slavery. So when some people are looking at these phenomena, they're seeing a through line going all the way back to a time when it was legal to own people. And also going along with that, in terms of things that have escalated police brutality, in many jurisdictions, police departments have become increasingly militarized. You can trace that back to the 60s and the 70s, but it really has also picked up a lot really in the last several decades. And so as historians, when we're looking at this moment, we're also, you know, thinking about 1968, but we're also going back many, many more decades, because for centuries, African Americans and their allies have used a variety of forms of protest to demand change, ranging back to direct action under the system of slavery itself or assistance in helping fugitives escape. You know, slave revolts in the 18th and 19th centuries, and then tracing up through the 20th century through the Selma March in 1965.
You know, speaking of 1968, because that is the year that a lot of people are drawing parallels mm-hmm. to, because you look online and you see pictures of police lines, you see pictures mm-hmm. of protesters. As a historian of American mm-hmm. history, what are you seeing as potential parallels, similarities, and any discrepancies or differences?
Yes, there definitely are both. Historians are always talking about context. You'll hear from most of us, you know, no two times are the same. So I would say there definitely are parallels, but there are limits to those parallels between these historical moments. You can see parallels in the sense that they're both moments in which people have risen up against multiple sources of oppression, including a strong movement by African Americans and like-minded folks against what we now call structural racism. In terms of some differences in 2020, certainly there are differences in leadership when we're talking about the presidential side of things. The sitting U.S. president in 1968 was Lyndon B. Johnson, and as both a congressional leader and as president, he was an advocate of civil rights measures through legal change, basically, and through his particular domestic policies. In terms of the current sitting president, Donald Trump has an overtly pro-policing approach in terms of his messages, and for decades he has identified with that law and order kind of stance. And we can date this back to his pre-political days in New York, most notably his actions in the 1989 Central Park 5 case.
Dana Weiner is an associate professor of American history at Wilfrid Laurier University, and you'll find extended coverage of the protests taking place in the United States and around the globe on our website, voanews.com. And coming up later...
It was Palestinian Lives Matter in Tel Aviv on Saturday, as Israelis demonstrated against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to extend sovereignty over parts of the occupied West Bank.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
With their striking appearance and bright pink plumage, flamingos are admired by people from all over the world. But did you know that flamingos aren't naturally pink? When born, they're actually either gray or white. According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the flamingos eventually get their pink coloring from the beta carotene, an organic pigment that's found in the food they eat, such as algae, larvae, and brine shrimp. A new study by researchers at the UK's University of Exeter and WWT Slimbridge Wetland Centre suggests that the more vivid the pink coloring is on a flamingo, the more aggressive they are compared to those who aren't as pink when fighting over food. According to study lead author Paul Rose of the University of Exeter, bright and colorful pink plumage shows that the flamingo is healthy, a good eater, and has the vitality to be aggressive and prevail at feeding time. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. China on Monday challenged U.S. Senator Rick Scott to show evidence supporting his accusation Beijing is trying to slow down or sabotage the development of a COVID-19 vaccine by Western countries. Scott declined to give details of the evidence when he was asked during an interview on Sunday, but said it had come through the intelligence community. U.S. President Donald Trump and other top officials in Washington have repeatedly criticized China's handling of the coronavirus outbreak, which has infected more than 4 million people globally and killed over 400,000. Experts in Florida also say people are becoming careless about physical distancing since statewide lockdowns have eased. They also note that the number of cases started rising when the George Floyd protests began. Officials in the Philippines announced Monday that tens of millions of children in the Philippines will not be allowed back to school until a coronavirus vaccine is available, saying they may have to broadcast the lessons on television. Some nations, such as France and South Korea, began resuming face-to-face classes as they got their outbreaks under control, but the Philippine authorities say the risk is too great. Elsewhere, New Zealand lifted most of its remaining COVID-19 restrictions on Monday. The government says there are no active coronavirus cases in the country. In a swift response to the pandemic, it had some of the toughest restrictions in the world during the month of March. Phil Mercer has that part of the story.
Under Alert Level 1, life in New Zealand will mostly return to what it was before the pandemic. Physical distancing will still be encouraged, but there'll be no restrictions on businesses or the number of people allowed at gatherings. Its international borders, however, will stay closed. There have been no new COVID-19 infections in New Zealand for 17 days. 40,000 people have been tested during that time. All returned negative results. Health officials believe that community transmission of the virus has been eliminated. The Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said the country of 5 million people had worked together to defeat the disease.
We New Zealanders did something remarkable in our fight to beat COVID-19. We united in unprecedented ways to crush the virus. We acknowledge those, however, that we have lost during the course of our battle against COVID-19. But we have worked together as well as we could to look after as many New Zealanders as possible.
The key challenge for the government is to revive the economy after weeks of lockdown. Opposition politicians in New Zealand said the Prime Minister had been too slow to remove most of the last remaining restrictions, but they conceded that it was a day of celebration. The Ministry of Health says there have been 1,504 confirmed and probable cases of COVID-19 in New Zealand. 22 people have died from the virus. The first positive diagnosis was recorded in late February. Authorities have urged New Zealanders to remain vigilant, stressing that the global pandemic will linger, with second waves a constant reality. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
We have more updates on the global pandemic on our website, voanews.com. An Iranian-American doctor has returned to Iran, according to Iranian state media on Monday. This was after a swap between Tehran and Washington that resulted in the release of a U.S. Navy veteran detained in Iran. In a slight thaw in U.S.-Iranian relations, the United States allowed Majid Tahiri to travel to Iran as part of the swap deal. Michael White, an American who said he contracted the coronavirus while detained in Iran, was freed last week. Tahiri, detained in the United States for 16 months for violating U.S. sanctions, was freed on June 4th as Iran released White, who had been sentenced to 13 years in 2019 for insulting Iran's supreme leader and posting private information online. Samsung Group's leader, JYE, appeared before a South Korean court Monday, awaiting a ruling on whether new allegations, including accounting fraud and stock manipulation, will send him back to jail after more than 2 years of freedom. Prosecutors last week asked the court to issue an arrest warrant against E, culminating a probe into a controversial 2015 merger of two Samsung affiliates that they said helped facilitate E's plan to assume greater control of the group. Scuffles broke out and several arrests were made as thousands of Israelis held a demonstration in Tel Aviv Saturday. Reuters reporter David Doyle has those details.
It was Palestinian Lives Matter in Tel Aviv on Saturday, as Israelis demonstrated against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to extend sovereignty over parts of the occupied West Bank. Thousands gathered in the city's Rabin Square, wearing face masks and keeping their distance from each other, as they heard a video address from U.S. Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders. He said it's never been more important to stand up for justice and to fight for the future we deserve. Some waved Palestinian flags and, as the action drew to a close, there were scuffles with police and several arrests. Palestinians want an independent state in the West Bank, East Jerusalem and the Gaza Strip, territories Israel captured in a 1967 Middle East war. But Netanyahu has set July the 1st as the date to begin advancing his plan to annex Israel's settlements and the Jordan Valley in the West Bank. He's hoping for a green light from Washington. US President Donald Trump has unveiled a peace plan that includes Israel keeping its settlements and the Palestinians establishing a state under stringent conditions. Palestinians have rejected that plan and voiced outrage against Israel's proposed annexation.
That was Reuters reporter David Doyle. And finally, work on Paris's famed Notre Dame Cathedral is entering a new phase during its repairs. As journalist Nicolas Pinault tells me via WhatsApp, workers are beginning to remove the charred and tangled scaffolding that melted atop the structure when it went up in flames just over a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. As someone living in Paris, I really found it, a little bit emotional to see these two teams of five workers being able to start working on ropes, in the heated wrapped web of scaffolding made up of 40,000 pieces. I mean, it's huge. It's almost
That's incredible.
88,000 pounds of metal, that, as you mentioned, melted during the fire, April 2019. So, I mean, for people living, in Paris area and for French people, we've come a lot. I mean, as you said, everything has paused during the pandemic. But then this operation, that's really the start of the reconstruction, because nothing can really happen until they remove the scaffolding that has burnt during the fire. So these two teams of five workers, they're going to rotate for several months now to be able to take all this material down, and then they're going to be able to reassess if the structure is still solid enough to be able to go from there and to rebuild, the heart of the cathedral that has suffered a major loss during the blaze last year.
I want to ask you, you mentioned there was quite a sight. You got a little bit emotional seeing the teams of five being lowered down into the cathedral to begin this reclamation work on the scaffolding that melted there. Do people gather around the cathedral during the day to watch the repair efforts because it is such an iconic part of France and Paris in particular?
And as a matter of fact, they do, because, the good news was 2 weeks ago when they reopened the space in front of Notre Dame, because, it has been closed since the catastrophe. You had some workers and you had the decontamination effort because you had a lot of lead who burnt during the fire and who poisoned the area around the building. And 2 weeks ago, the French authorities and the city of Paris, they reopened this space right in front of the cathedral. So as of right now, and I know that's going to be the beauty for tourists, but also for Parisians, because it's an important landmark for our city, we can now, again, go back and see Notre Dame and what's going on. And some people, they would go back and pray, and some people, they would just visit and some take some pictures. But yeah, for the past 2 weeks, we've been able to walk near Notre Dame. We still have a long way to go until we can be able to access inside the building, but at least being so close. And it's also a relief, for the shops around Notre Dame, because they took a pretty heavy hit during the crisis and for the past year. And, the cafe and the bookstores around Notre Dame, now they can see more people coming around, and it's a relief. And, it's a signal also that life basically is coming back to normal.
Nicolas Pinault is a reporter living in Paris, France. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.